Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Delighted because with us today is A.L. Press, an author and prolific journalist whose work concentrates on ethics and social justice. And this is the guy who is this year's James H. Ottaway Senior Visiting Professor of Journalism at SUNY New Paltz. Press is teaching an upper-level journalism seminar this semester called Reporting on Divisive Subjects, which promises to pose questions about the challenges reporters face when they choose to write about emotionally fraught subjects and to introduce students to journalists' varied approaches to meeting those challenges. A.L. Press is the author of Beautiful Souls, Saying No, Breaking Ranks, and Heeding the Voice of Conscience in Dark Times, a book of narrative journalism that considers the choices and dilemmas faced by those who reject duty and the expectations of others in order to remain true to their principles. His previous book, Absolute Convictions, is a personal account of conflicts between abortion providers, protesters, and politicians. His articles have appeared widely in publications including The New York Times and The Nation. Press is a 2016 Visiting Journalist Fellow at the Russell Sage Foundation, which supports journalists in projects related to the foundation's mission of the improvement of social and living conditions in the United States. He's also a recipient of the James Aronson Award for Social Justice Journalism, a prize presented annually by Hunter College of the City of New York in recognition of original reporting that brings to light widespread injustices, examines their causes, and searches for possible reforms. His prior teaching experience includes serving as a visiting scholar at the Institute for Public Knowledge. We'll talk to him about all of this and much more, but first, welcome, A.L. Press. How are you?
Thank you very much.
Where does the word ale come from?
It's Hebrew. I was born in Israel, and it means deer, the animal, deer.
Wow. And when did you come to the country?
When I was 2.5 years old, a long time ago. Into age, but decades.
What do your folks do, or did they do?
Well, my father is actually relevant to some of my writing because he is an obstetric gynecologist who came to this country in 1973, practiced medicine, finished his training, and ended up becoming an abortion provider, or rather, abortion was part of the practice he did in Buffalo, New York. And that is the subject of my first book that you mentioned, Absolute Convictions, the sort of turmoil that racked the city for decades, actually.
And how close was he to the fellow who got shot?
He was very close. As you mentioned, there was a physician in Amherst, New York, a suburb of Buffalo, Barnett Slepian, who was murdered while standing in the kitchen of his home in 1998. It was one in a series of murders and attempted murders that took place in the mid-1990s, targeting abortion providers. And Barnett Slepian was a physician my father knew personally, and of course he knew the family as well. And it was actually after the murder that I decided this issue, which I'd grown up really not wanting to talk about at all, much less to write about, that I decided I needed in some way to go back and trace, you know, how all of this had led to such a tragic outcome and event.
Do you remember, A.L., do you remember the discussions in your home about what had happened?
Very much so. You know, if you're talking about Dr. Slepian's murder, yeah. You know, I came home immediately. I wasn't living in Buffalo at the time. And it was a period of just tremendous uncertainty, fear, concern, befuddlement, sadness.
I didn't hear one word in there, which was anger.
Anger as well. No question. I think that's a very interesting point. I think the anger was in some sense so overwhelming that, and maybe I mention it because it's obvious to me, it's self-evident. You know, as I was about to say, Dr. Slepian had 4 sons and a surviving widow. He also had patients who relied on him. He had colleagues who he worked with. He was providing legal service. And however you feel about abortion, you know, there are decisions made that as citizens in a democracy, we are supposed to respect. And so in a way, however, I think that not mentioning the anger is in a sense the strategy I took to writing about the subject, that I felt I had to harness some of that and do the job that a reporter must do, which is to understand the roots of a problem. You have to go out and talk to people and think about, you know, different positions on a perspective. And so the book is not just, you know, an angry screed.
Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a sister.
And did the two of you argue with your father that he should either continue to do what he was doing or stop doing abortions?
I did, more so than my sister did. Yeah, again, just to take you back to that moment, this was a moment when not only had a physician my father known and worked with, and they worked together covering deliveries, that is, delivering babies, mothers who would then send them flowers with photographs of the kids they had delivered. And that's what I grew up knowing my father did, because that was what we got from patients of his. I didn't really know anything about the abortion issue. And then I learned that it was a part of the practice that he was involved in. But in 1998, when this happened, immediately after Dr. Slepian was shot, my father was threatened personally, and there was a threat that he was next on the list.
How did it arrive? In a letter, in a phone call? How did it arrive?
It actually arrived via the news, and it was, I believe it was a newspaper in Canada that had received the threat, and then it became front page news in Buffalo and elsewhere. You know, and this is sort of a theme of the work I've done since then in different ways. My father and I were engaged in a conversation about how far should someone go for the sake of a principle. And in my father's case, the principle was kind of twofold. One is serving his patients. And I think that he always viewed and still views abortion first and foremost as a medical procedure, and one that if you ban it, it will continue. It will go on. It just won't be done in a safe way. And so that was the first thing. And then I think the second thing was not to give in to violence and to extremists and to people who threaten others. And he was born and raised in Israel, as I mentioned. And that's a pretty foundational principle in that country's history. So, you know, in some sense, he was thrown into exactly the kind of situation that his background prepared him for, and he didn't give an inch.
You mentioned, you know, how you stick with your principles. Have you given any consideration to the murderers who thought that, you know, God was telling them to protect these unborn children, and therefore, you know, anything was legitimate because they were acting from God's perspective as opposed to legal, to our foundational laws?
Yeah, there's a lot in the book that sort of where I write about those questions. And, you know, we see those questions come up not just in the context of the abortion debate. I mean, the claim that God's law is above the law, sure, the secular law, and that therefore that warrants taking the law into one's own hands is a claim that we see playing out throughout the world right now, not just in the abortion conflict, and certainly not just in the United States. You know, that the claim to martyrdom, the claim to, you know, in Israel-Palestine, you have both Muslims and Jews who claim that God tells them to take the law into their own hands, and sometimes violently. And so, in some sense, that it's not a unique question. It's not a question unique to the abortion conflict, and in this country, you know, we just happen to have a particularly polarized public when it comes to that issue.
Indeed. I have a cousin who was shoved in front of a subway car by a woman, and they got her, and they put her on trial, and her defense was that Jesus told her to do it. and one person, they got a hung jury, because one person on the jury said, well, Jesus told her, then that's what happened. So the second jury, of course, convicted her. Nevertheless, this concept of God being greater than our temporal laws, a very interesting one for writers like yourself when you try to figure out what it's all about.
Absolutely. In that case, I think that, yeah, I mean, I'm surprised to hear that about the jury. But certainly, you know, and again, I think that, you know, my second book, Beautiful Souls, which is about people who disobey orders that conflict with their principles, and who take these very risky and courageous stands on principle. Well, those kinds of acts are very easy to admire when you share the principles of the person making them, right? So, for example, Martin Luther King today in the United States, sort of universally, or not universally, but fairly broad consensus that, you know, the kind of civil disobedience he led, the willingness to go to prison to fight the Jim Crow system and segregation, that was valiant and it was admirable, and so he's honored. But when you don't share the principles, and let's not forget that when King was doing that, his principles were not shared, certainly not in the South and also not in large parts of the North, what you have
You mean not universally shared, because certainly there were people who shared those principles.
Not universally shared. In some places, not shared by the majority, much a minority view. Then you have to raise the question, how do you view these acts, and where is the line between a sort of principled act of non-cooperation and an act of zealotry? And I think ultimately we have to judge these acts by the content of the act. You know, it's not enough to say, someone is acting in accordance with their convictions and therefore it's legitimate. We inevitably are going to have to discuss what those convictions are. When we look back at the civil rights era, we see that there were people breaking the law to broaden the rights that citizens had and extend them to African Americans. There were also people breaking the law to preserve the system of segregation, right? White citizens' councils and so forth. And that's a huge difference, obviously.
Right. And those things change yearly in terms of what we're willing to accept as legitimate action in defense of a principle, yes?
Absolutely. Yeah. No. And I think that ultimately, in a sense, history is the judge of these things. So, in terms of the moral stakes in that conflict and the kinds of disobedience that were practiced, it's pretty clear today, you know, who we should honor and who we should not. But in the heat of the battle, it's a very different story.
Well, they arrested Pete Seeger, my friend, and they put him before the various committees, and he got a year in jail, which he didn't serve because it got reversed. Nevertheless, his manager told me once that he was ticked off that he didn't get more than that 1 year, and he didn't have to be in jail, you know, for longer than a couple of hours, which I think was upsetting to him. He was willing to do that and to know what the consequences
That reminds me, that's a great story, and it reminds me of there's a section in Beautiful Souls, my book, about Henry David Thoreau,
sure,
of course, and I don't know if it's actually verified or if it's just legend, but you know the story where he's apparently asked, I think by Emerson, Thoreau, what are you doing in jail? And his answer is, what are you doing out there? I'm paraphrasing, but basically that's the sort of impulse that, in his case, what he saw as a clearly unjust law, he welcomed the opportunity not to have to pay taxes to a government that was, supporting slavery.
When you look at your own political positions, I hate to do this to you, but just for the listener's edification, if I asked you on a political spectrum whether you saw yourself as to the left or to the right, what would you say?
Oh, I think I would say I'd have to be honest and say I'm to the left. I think it wouldn't take too long for someone to, my book about abortion is very sympathetic to the perspective of those fighting for reproductive rights and freedom. I've written quite a lot about human rights. I've written critically about some of the policies adopted by the U.S. government after 9/11, including torture. Wrote one of the first pieces about what I saw as a disastrous embrace of torture by the U.S. government. But having said that, I think there are journalists who would say, I have no opinion. You know, I'm a neutral observer. Okay. I wouldn't say that about myself. Having said that, I would say that I strive in my work to test my own assumptions and to approach, especially when I'm interviewing people, to approach them with an open mind. I think the job of a journalist to some extent is to try to put yourself in the shoes of the people you're writing about. And if those people don't share your views, then you have to work all the harder to try to do that. Again, you may completely disagree with them. You may end up pointing out why you believe they are wrongheaded. But it's still necessary, I think, to make the case to try to see things from another person's point of view. I think that you do a disservice to your readers and to your own work when you don't do that. And as you mentioned, I'm teaching now at SUNY New Paltz, and that's something I've tried to really convey to the students there, that no matter how passionately held a position you have about something, you know, you're better off making a strong argument for your opponent. Then you can move on. You can go on to make it clear through your writing and whatever you say and whatever you report on that's not your position. But even so, it will only strengthen your work. Because if you don't do that, beyond just sort of doing a disservice to your reader, you will very likely end up being discounted. And there are a great many people in this country, I think, whose views don't align so cleanly on one side or the other. And, you know, one would want to reach them. I mean, if you only present one view, I think you're less likely to do so.
We're talking with author, journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Sr., visiting professor of journalism at SUNY New Paltz, IL Press. I'm Alan Shartok, and let's continue. So I guess the thing I want to know is I have challenged some of my colleagues in journalism because I truly believe that I should tell people what I'm going to do so that I can be judged in terms of the quality of my questions. This is something that's very challenging for people in journalism. I said, for example, I'm going to vote for Bernie Sanders. This is not an endorsement. I'm the president of this fairly large public radio station. This is not an endorsement from the station, but I think you ought to know where I'm coming from when I discuss these things. How do you feel about that?
Well, I think it's great. You know, and not just because I happen to lean the same way. You know, the very first week of class, my students and I discussed objectivity, the question of objectivity. Can journalists be objective? And should they even try to be objective? And, you know, I think that there's a lot to the critique of, and I think this really resonates with young people today, that, you know, nobody comes at an issue from a neutral point of view. And if you pretend you do, and that can be as dishonest as anything else.
Mm-hmm.
And so I heard that, you know, from some of the students. And I think there's a real legitimacy to it. And too often, the claim to be objective ends up being a kind of he said, she said that can be very lazy.
Sure.
For example, in the debate about climate change, you know, for years you had, you know, newspapers quoting someone who thought it was a problem and someone who happened to be affiliated with the petroleum industry, who we later learn, who didn't think it was a problem. Well, now that's changed a little bit because there is basically a scientific consensus that we have a huge problem that and then the fate of the planet is at stake in this. So objectivity in that kind of example can be a kind of lazy way to report.
Except that many editors believe that that's the case, that you have to have the other side, quote.
That's true that people believe that. And again, to go back to what I said before, I guess I would want to unpack the phrase have the other side. So, you know, if one person thinks the earth is flat and the other disagrees, well, to present those two views as equally valid is is troubling.
I always use the Holocaust as an example.
You know. That's a better one. But the point is, I think that what I'm interested in as a reader as much as a writer is writers and journalists and reporters who do the work of trying to explain what they're seeing and trying to analyze it. And that's not easy. It takes work. It takes thought. It takes, you know, weighing the validity of different opinions that you hear. But to me, it makes us a more informed public if more of us do that in the press. And, you know, I should say I do a particular kind of journalism, so I'm sort of free of the kind of strictures, as I imagine you are as well,
sure.
free of the strictures of kind of having no opinion on anything. I write for magazines mostly. I write books. I write essays and some criticism. And even when I do reporting, it tends to be longer, more story-driven. There's room for explanatory and analytical, for a voice in that kind of work. There often isn't in a 250-word news flash, you know?
So let's take an example which causes me great discomfiture as a Jewish person, and that is Israel and the Palestinians. You know, I was raised in a home where Israel could do no wrong, period, end of discussion. And when these subjects come up, some of that early Freudian character stuff kicks in. How about you?
I was raised in a similar kind of home. I've written a little bit about that in my book, actually, which includes a soldier, the story of a soldier, an Israeli soldier, who becomes a conscientious objector. And this soldier did not begin as a critic of the Israeli army. His name is Avner. To the contrary, he entered the most elite unit of the army, and he did so with enormous pride. And he would himself say a kind of ultra-patriot. And if you had asked me at age 16 or 17, my own views, they would have mirrored his. I grew up in a very similar kind of context and cultural background. I don't hold the view today by any stretch that Israel can do no wrong. To the contrary, I have written at considerable length about the moral and political consequences of the occupation, which has now existed for the majority of Israel's existence, the occupation of land seized in the 1967 war. I've written about Palestinians who live without basic rights that Israelis exercise. And so I've gone through a significant evolution in my views on that subject. Unfortunately, as my views have moved in a more critical direction, the Israeli government and it seems the Israeli public has grown increasingly right-wing.
Again, your ability, which you articulated so well before, to try to understand the other side. Do you get that? In other words, is there another side that would be explanatory? Or, quote, the Arabs are out to push us into the sea, and they are not a democratic type society. So therefore, you know, anything we do is justified. Do you get that part?
Well, I hear it all the time. You know, it's not hard to hear that point of view. I think it's dishonest for people who criticize Israel to claim that, you know, if Israel only did the right thing, everybody would accept it and it lives, you know, the country is in this nice neighborhood where its neighbors just want to respect its citizens. I don't think that's true. I also don't think it's relevant to the question of the occupation of land that is illegally occupied, that deprives Palestinians of basic rights, that humiliates and degrades and immiserates another people, and that also has had a toxic and poisonous effect on Israel itself. And, you know, I'm not by no means alone in saying that. So, you know, there is complexity to the history there, certainly. I'm of the view that, you know, in 1948, when the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians, well, some would trace it far earlier, of course, but when Israel, during what it calls the Independence War and Palestinians refer to as the catastrophe, I'm of the view that at that moment it was a clash between a right and a right rather than a right and a wrong. You know, there are people who don't agree with that. But again, having said that, it doesn't justify everything that was done. You know, there were hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes. They have rights. They have stories. They have a equal claim to having their narrative recognized and incorporated. So it's, again, when one writes about these issues, I think it's important to try to go beyond just a sort of simplistic view that boils it all down to one thing.
Well, I started teaching at New Paltz in 1970. And therefore, you know, I've been there for a long, long time, one way or the other, the Legislative Gazette newspaper, which I started, the other stuff. I want to talk to you a little bit about your students and the quality of your students. I don't know, have you ever had an experience teaching in a independent or private college?
Well, I've taught at Hunter College in New York.
Which is where I graduated from, so yeah.
Ah.
Yeah, so I know a little about it, yeah.
So what I would say, I've had some very illuminating conversations with students at SUNY New Paltz. I'm fairly new there, but I've really enjoyed talking to the students, both my students and students in the classes that I've dropped in on, and that's part of what I do while I'm there. And because this is an election year, and there's been a lot of talk about how young millennials and young people are viewing the world and voting, I've heard a lot from them and had some fascinating conversations, and I've just really come away with a great deal of respect for these students and for the very different world they're entering. And when one issue that has really jumped out in those conversations is the onerous nature of student debt today. And you have, you know, there are some students from more affluent backgrounds at SUNY New Paltz who can get through the four-year program without accumulating debt. But all of the students I spoke to were going to have to pay off debt, and they were working. Sometimes one person was working three jobs while taking classes. And, you know, when I think about the fact that a lot of these students are in-state, they're going to a state institution, there's something wrong. There's something wrong with a society where, particularly because, you know, and this is a point that I think Bernie Sanders has made, a college degree today, just a BA, is somewhat akin to what a high school diploma was, you know, 30, 40 years ago. It's a basic thing you need, but it by no means guarantees you a job. And some of these kids are already thinking about, you know, the next program, the training program or advanced education program they enter, which will mean more debt. So I've been struck by that. I think they are very different from, I think that the media has a bias in reporting disproportionately about students in very elite universities, very elite institutions, And as a result, you get a portrait of a kind of very coddled and entitled student today. And I think that needs correcting.
So the reason I asked you about this is that I have found in my fairly long number of years that there's a difference in sensibilities. It's very risky to talk this way, but between those who go to the independent or the private colleges, which cost maybe $60,000 a year, and some of those who can hardly afford to pay the state university prices. When I went to Hunter, which I mentioned a few seconds ago, it was free. And I couldn't agree with you more, the idea that if you're talking quality of opportunity, you're going to send kids to elementary school and to secondary school, that included in that equality of opportunity is sending them to a four-year college. Nevertheless, I think we're on a divided, segregated path between those who are sort of clawing their way up into the middle class and those who are there by a substantial margin. Are you following me?
Yes. No, and I think that division even exists to some extent. I heard this within the student body at SUNY New Paltz. In other words, that there is a kind of minority of students who are not going to places like Bard and other schools because it's cheaper. But for them, this is the cheap option. And then you have a lot of students who it's not cheap at all. You know, they're struggling Sure. every day with what it costs. So, I definitely think there is this division. I think it's a scandal in our society that we have not made progress, and maybe we've gone backwards in some ways in sort of how the prospects you have in your life will be shaped by the material conditions you're born into. That just seems to me profoundly wrong. And that we haven't made more progress in that is really a shame.
And yet you take City College of New York and look at how many Nobel Prize winners, and I think it's the all-time high, maybe Harvard, but it's a lot. So sometimes mm-hmm. the struggle is worth it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And I have to say I'm just very impressed with the level of engagement I've seen from the students that I've met.
So let me throw out an idea about students at our institution, SUNY New Paltz, that has been so important and recognizable for me, and that is, if you say, okay, what's the number one thing that really gets students interested? It's that somebody's been out there, a teacher, for example, has been out there and done it, quote, done it. And also, tell me how I can survive. Tell me how I can get a job.
Mm-hmm.
And we know, as you say, that the circumstances are very different now than even just a few years ago.
Yeah. And, I think that I hope I can, bring a little bit of the sort of, being in the mix of it to my students to the students I've been meeting. How to go out there and carve out a career of some kind as a journalist. Having said that, sometimes I feel like I'm talking about the 19th century when I started out, because it was a world of print journalism that I entered. It was also a world where magazines seemed to be flourishing, and as we know only too well, the internet has caused a sea change, and a lot of magazines have disappeared. They're struggling to make it every year. Newspapers, I think, are even in worse shape. And so the landscape has changed really profoundly. And I'm not, unfortunately, in a great position to tell young people, oh, this is how you start writing online, because I didn't do it. And I still don't. I mean, everything I write nowadays, I push my editors to put it online because I know that's what will get it read. If it's behind a firewall, it's hard to do that. But the fact of the matter is I've blogged very little in my life, and I don't have a lot of experience to draw on to tell them this. But in a way, I think it wouldn't help for me to help to try to navigate that world for them, because they're so much more advanced than I am. They read more online publications. They're more adept when it comes to using digital technology and various devices and social media. So all those things they know are, in a sense, the things they need that I can't tell them. But, of course, they also need institutions and publications that will hire them to do meaningful work. And that remains a big challenge, I think.
We're talking with author, journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Sr., visiting professor of journalism at SUNY New Paltz, IL Press. Okay, so Eyal, I guess the next issue is, do you think that we as teachers are offering the possibility of jobs to people who don't have a real chance of getting them, number one, and what does that mean we are? What does that make us into? And the idea that there's at least one law student, previous law student, who is suing her university, her law school, because, you know, she may have been led to believe that more was possible in terms of vocation than there actually was out there. Is this a moral quandary for us?
I think it's a moral quandary for anyone who teaches at a journalism school these days. That doesn't mean you shouldn't do it. That doesn't mean it's wrong because, you know, a lot of the students, first of all, in things like, you know, broadcast news and digital media and all kinds of things are growing rather than shrinking. So it's not as though you can say it's all just, you know, a sort of diminishing job market. But I think if it's a professional school and a journalism school and you're teaching magazine writing, you have to be honest with the students that, you know, this was always a hard way to make a living. It was never easy. And it's probably harder today than ever before. And so, you know, one has to be honest about that. And I think that I would struggle with that. Having said that, I'm not teaching at a professional school. I'm teaching undergraduate students who are journalism majors. Many of them are journalism majors. And to me, that's very freeing because what I'm teaching, I hope, is how to think, how to ask questions, how to engage a subject, how to approach a subject, how to find sources, how to learn and question one's assumptions. All of those things are those are the things that I value most about my own undergraduate education. And I was a history major. I learned nothing about
Where at did you do that work?
At Brown University.
Okay, so that's really you know, creme de la creme.
Yes, it is very creme de la creme. And I have to say that as I reflect upon it more and more, of course, when I was going through it, I had the marvelous obliviousness to my own privilege, but to have been sent to such a wonderful school, and it was really, really did change my life to go to Brown, and it is a great school, and was very well suited for my interests. I majored in history; it had a great history department. But to be able to go there and also to graduate without debt, which I did, is just, you know, for a student today, you know, it's just increasingly out of reach, and that's part of the reason I find it so unfair and wrong that so many students don't have that. I would guess that most of the writers I know today who went into journalism and went into various forms of creative work, whether it's editing or publishing books or writing books or making films, that most of those people graduated school without the burden of heavy debts to pay off, you know, 20, 30 years ago, 20 years ago. And that's huge because those things are so, those are such interesting things to do. And they're such important things to do, I think. And I want to try, and I try to convey that to my students that, you know, there is real merit to this work. It's incredibly interesting and it can be incredibly important. And it can have a positive social outcome or influence. But for it to just be closed off to so many people who would have an interest in it because of financial constraints is just that we got to change that.
Do you think when you talk to the kids at New Paltz, the students at New Paltz, do you compare your time at Brown with who you're talking to at New Paltz?
I haven't so much. I did have a conversation with the students at one point about political correctness and, you know, in part because, of course, Donald Trump has used that phrase in his demagogic appeals, saying, you know, he's just battling political correctness. And then he promptly insults another group, whether it's Mexicans or Muslims or women. You know, so it's this kind of straw man, I think. But then there also is a level of reality to it, certainly on some college campuses, and it was certainly true at Brown, that there was a certain amount of political correctness that I think was unfortunate. And so I kind of asked the students, you know, what does that phrase mean to them? Do they feel encumbered by this in any way?
I was just arguing Bernie versus Hillary with a colleague on the radio, and She accused me of saying something just because you don't like women. I mean, when you think about contemporary feminism, by the way, that's not true. I love women. But when you think about contemporary feminism, it seems to me it's a little bit of a trap, which is we want equality, you get equality. But if Bernie Sanders stands up and says to Hillary Clinton, you know, I'm not through with my sentence yet, it's regarded as being condescending and unacceptable when you're dealing with a woman who has special privilege. What do you make of that?
Well, I saw that clip in the debate. I didn't see the whole debate, so I don't know exactly how it happened. But my impression is that Bernie Sanders would have, and one of the commentators I saw said this, that Bernie Sanders would have said that to a man he was debating.
Absolutely.
As well,
yeah.
if he had gotten interrupted.
That's my whole point, yeah.
So I think in that case, to see it through that lens is a mistake. You know, and I also think it's important to note that I actually, when I had a conversation about Sanders versus Clinton at the first conversation I had at New Paltz, it was a class full of very articulate women, mostly women, and most of them were Sanders supporters. These were younger women.
Yeah, the polling data, by the way, substantiates that across the board.
And they were very passionate about this. And I asked them, in a sense, the question their comments begged, which was, don't you want to see a woman become president? You know, and what they said was, various people said different things, but, you know, yes, we do, but it doesn't have to be this particular woman. And that's an interesting point. In a sense, they expect a woman to be president during their lifetime, right? They don't think that it has to be right now, that this is the moment and it will pass and that's it. I hope they're right because, you know, I'm all for having women in positions of power in this society. I think that, you know, the existence of various forms of bias and discrimination is very real and has operated as long as this country's been around. But that doesn't necessarily mean, okay, this is the one moment and therefore you have to support this person. I think that's what I was hearing from these younger women about Hillary.
So can you draw any kind of comparison or lesson by saying, okay, first woman president, first black president? In other words, the idea that we had the first black president in Barack Obama, is that different than having the first woman president?
Hmm.
I'm glad I made you say that.
I'd need to give that more thought. I mean, you know, I think that one of the lessons of having the first black president, and by the way, when Obama was running in 2008, I was sure he just couldn't be elected. I just couldn't believe, based on studying American history, based on the use of race as a tool to divide people in this country, I just didn't believe that people really would vote for him. I mean, I kind of, you know, read all that stuff about how, well, that's what they tell pollsters, but it won't bear out. Mm. And then it did. And so that was kind of an amazing, amazing moment, I think.
Did you
whatever
think,
you make of...
Let me interrupt and ask you just as an ancillary question. Did you think that we would see this quickly people who are gay or lesbian being allowed to marry in the United States?
Absolutely not. No. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that's
so what's that all about?
Thing.
That's all about the kids at New Paltz, isn't it?
It is. It's about young people and how much cooler they are about these issues than their elders, in my view. You know, how much more tolerant the society's... We talked earlier about Israel.
I was going to go there.
Draw a contrast for you. Sure. I've written about this a little bit. To me, one of the most hopeful things about the United States is that the younger you go, the more tolerant you seem to find people are, whether it's about issues of how people define family and marriage and sexual orientation to, you know, tolerance of minorities and others. In Israel, the polling data that I find most disturbing and upsetting, and it's a lot of data at this point, showing that the younger you go, the less tolerant you get. In other words, people have more proclivity to racist views, particularly of Arabs. People have a less of an attachment to free speech and democratic values and tolerance. That is a very, very alarming thing in any society, I think. And it's, to me, it's a big cloud over, you know, what's going to happen in that country in the future, what kind of country it will be internally.
No, I mean, when you think about it, I don't know if you have kids, but, you know, you bring a kid to get bar mitzvah in Israel. It's no easy deal. You have to have an Orthodox rabbi, as I last remember seeing that. That ain't good.
Yes, no, that's right. Mm. And you know, the secular, more liberal secular Israelis are outnumbered.
Mm-hmm.
Increasingly.
Although it can certainly be said that there is a substantial group of Israelis who, you know, eschew some of the old ways.
Absolutely.
Isn't white the number one meat in Israel right now?
You mean pork?
Yes.
I don't know the answer to that. I will tell you that you can get all kinds of deliciously non-kosher food in Tel Aviv, where the sort of culinary and other things are you know, not so different from a place like New York City.
Speaking of which, do you like to cook?
I do.
What do you cook?
What do I cook?
Yeah.
I mostly follow recipes of either friends. I have a number of friends who are just terrific, both terrific writers and happen to be terrific chefs. And so some of them will sort of, you know, pass me recipes. There's a lamb ragu I make that a friend of mine made for me once, and it never fails. I like to cook Italian. Yeah, I really enjoy it. It's a great way to, listening to music and cooking, I find to be one of the great ways to get out of one's head. And so, you know, and meanwhile, you're doing something that eventually you'll be able to enjoy.
And what is your favorite? And what is your favorite music?
Oh, well, are we talking musician or music? Musician.
Go any way you like. Go any way you like.
I'm a quasi-Dylanologist. I mean, I was obsessed throughout my college years and well into my 20s and 30s. You know, it's waned a little bit, I would say. You have to diversify at some point, but not that much. I still, you know, I'll still go to him when I really just, you know, crave hearing one of those just amazing records or bootlegs.
Interesting. We have a colleague here at the radio station who wrote a book about Dylan and basically his Jewish roots.
Oh, wow.
Seth Rogerboy. You might look that one up. Interesting.
Thank you. I will. Yeah, I just read, not long ago, I read Positively Fourth Street, a book about Dylan and his...
I know it well. Yeah.
And wonderful book.
Yeah, I know it well. It's amazing. Is it possible to love the output of an artist, but not to think that you would really want to have a beer with him?
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, if you've read Positively Fourth Street, the idea of a beer with Dylan might give you pause. That said, I would do just about anything to have a beer with Dylan.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what he'd say to me. He could be rude or brusque or get up from the table and decide he doesn't want my company. I'd still welcome the opportunity. And I don't think I'm alone in that.
Treasure the experience. So Dylan, of course, you know, started out as Zimmerman and was Jewish and then converted. And then apparently is either converted back or his kids have converted back. Who knows? It's very interesting. Does that mean anything to you?
Not that much in terms of why I love his work and his... I mean, it's interesting just because he's interesting. But I don't know that, you know... I have to say that, you know, he's gone through a lot of religious phases. I haven't followed them as closely as I've followed the phases of his music. I find the music just what's truly and deeply captivating. I will say on a very funny note, I don't know if you saw the article that Dylan's songs are the most quoted by, is it Supreme Court justices? Right. And so I tweeted that day. I am on Twitter, and I tweeted that day that I'm guessing those certain songs, among the songs not heavily featured in those quotes, would be you know, The Lonesome Death of Hattie Carroll, and probably also Hurricane. You know, these are songs that skewer the judicial system and the notion of justice in this country.
Are you interested in the fact that when we go to see a Dylan concert and he plays small baseball parks, he has where we live in Berkshire County, that quite frequently he'll use the lyrics, but he'll change the music?
Yeah, that's very interesting. I've seen him do that a lot. I saw him at the Erie County Fair, which was just great. I've seen him in some small venues, and yeah, he seems to need to keep everybody guessing, including himself. So, and of course, the variations of the lyrics of some of the songs that appear in acoustic form in one version and on a different album. I love that stuff. You know, I think it's great.
Do you ever think you'd see a day that Pete Seeger would be up there in an inauguration of a president of the United States singing and playing when we know what the background was?
Yeah, it's well, and Dylan received a Medal of Honor, right?
Mm-hmm. I mean,
So yeah, you know, and we talked earlier about, I mean, time has an amazing way to make a society appreciate its troublemakers. And you know, I think this will be true of Edward Snowden, by the way.
Yeah, I think you're right.
I think that 20 or 30 years from now, people will say whistleblowers like Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden in the same sentence, and it will be understood that these were people who risked everything for a principle that was a worthy one. But of course, now we're in the heat of the moment, and so you hear Ted Cruz recently. I was cringing watching the Republican debate when Snowden's name came up. I thought, okay, who's going to be first to call him a traitor? It took like 2 seconds. And then the second thing was, you know, and when am I going to hear that he's not a whistleblower? And of course, I think it was Ted Cruz actually who said he's not a whistleblower. And I actually wrote an essay a while ago for the New York Review of Books pointing out that actually he's like a textbook whistleblower. He's exactly what a whistleblower
sure.
is. But the problem with these pronouncements from politicians is that they want us to think a whistleblower is someone who everyone agrees with. They do the right thing and we all agree. That's the opposite of a whistleblower. A whistleblower is someone who always causes trouble by challenging their superiors and their authorities and, you know, in this case, the government. They're never popular until well after the fact. And so, you know, I think that Snowden's day for winning a popularity contest will come. It's just in the future. And by the way, he is already very popular among young people.
I'll bet. You know, my favorite channel, being an old person, is the Old Time Movie Channel, the Turner Classic Movies. And I turned on the other day, and there was a film starring James Arness and John Wayne together as investigators for the House American Activities Committee going after communists. And finding these terrible Stalinist communists who wanted to basically blow up America during that time. And I sat there with my mouth open. You know, there are some things in life you don't want to see. You know, if you like James Arness and you like Gunsmoke, you don't want to see a guy like that. In a film like that. But it happened, so we compartmentalized and we put it somewhere else.
Well, I myself just read a novel about the McCarthy era, Philip Roth's I Married a Communist. And there's
great
a description
book.
In the book,
yeah.
great book, and there's a description in the book of Joseph McCarthy in which which word for word could apply to Donald Trump today. That's just, I was stopped cold after I read it and thought, wow, you could really just, and basically what he says is, you know, McCarthy was never in the politics business, and he knew that if no one else did. He was an entertainer. He was a charlatan. He said what he... He played it. He played the entertainment game. The wilder the accusations got, the more fun everybody had. That's a large part of Trump's shtick, I think.
Well,
I think
right. The problem is that the alternatives don't look much better.
And, well, that's
and
true.
Certainly, Ted Cruz, I think, by the way, as we speak today, that if Ted Cruz were the candidate against Hillary— or Bernie, but it'll probably be Hillary, he would be defeated at a much larger level than if Trump were the candidate.
I think that's true. I think that's true. By the way, I should say, we talked about objectivity in the media. I have been dismayed by the presumption that the Democratic nomination is over. You know, Bernie Sanders won 3 of 4 states by sizable margins over. He probably will lose. I think that, you know, I've looked at the polling data and the paths to the nomination and so forth. Okay, he probably will lose. But come on, folks. You know, if Hillary had won 3 of 4 decisively, I'm guessing we would have seen a headline in the New York Times saying, you know, Clinton, you know, barrels ahead, you know,
okay,
crushing
so
Sanders in three.
Okay,
yeah.
So stop. Because we only have 2 minutes and 53 seconds, I want to ask you really quickly. So do you
yes.
think the New York Times is non-objective when it comes to this race?
I have felt that the coverage of the debates has often read like press releases from the Clinton camp, and I'm not singling out any particular journalist. I've watched the debates. I thought they were pretty even. Then I've read the coverage the next day in the Times and thought, was that the debate I saw? So it felt slanted to me. Having said that, I will say that the Times ran a 2-part story, which everybody should read, about Hillary Clinton's role in Libya. and the lessons that were not learned. And that piece pointed out that people like Joe Biden learned from the Iraq War, we shouldn't do regime change. Hillary used this thinking it's all going to go great once again, and she thought she will use this in her campaign. It was the Times that ran those pieces. So it's, you know, it's not, I don't think it's a uniform sort of let's get behind her. But that said, I don't think Sanders is getting the attention in that paper and in other places that the coverage that he deserves.
Is the New York Times a better or worse newspaper? Is it evolved in a positive direction or a negative direction?
I think it's a better newspaper today than it's ever been. I think that it's more open. I think it has more variety in its pages. I like a lot of the the Opinionator, and they're deeply committed to both narrative journalism and investigative reporting. I think it's a better paper.
Our guest, and he has been a terrific guest, is the author, journalist, and this year's James H. Ottaway Jr., visiting professor of journalism at SUNY New Paltz, IL Press. IL, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been a real pleasure. You're a thoughtful guy, and I'm going to run out and buy your books. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much
for being with us.
Thanks so much for having me on. It was a lot of fun.
Been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.